Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston. Subscribe to the show on YouTube, everyone, because I'm posting videos there, along with everything that you're hearing wherever you get your podcast. And also, please subscribe to the show and give it a decent review, too. I would greatly appreciate that. Lots to talk about here this week, but coming up in a few moments, education scholar and Western Michigan University professor Dr. Julian Vasquez-Heilig will be my guest this week to talk about how President Elon Musk and Dear Leader Trump are attacking our nation's public universities and K-12 schools by trying to intimidate them into ending their diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. See, they're trying to shake down public education by threatening to slash federal dollars, which has always been the endgame for the corporate authoritarian elites who now have power in the upper echelons of our government. So stay tuned for that. And then in my last call, I will have some opinions on Michigan Democratic Senator Alyssa Slotkin's rebuttal to Dear Leader's speech to Congress this week. Hey, before I forget, I just saw this headline before pressing the record button, but it appears MAGA Michigan Republicans want dangerous people to once again carry guns in the state. Our good friend, reporter John King from Michigan Advance, released a story detailing how MAGA Republican State Representative James DeSana from Carrollton, is it Carrollton or Carrollton? There's a Carrollton around Saginaw, I know that, but we'll call it Carrollton, which is in Monroe County. Well, he introduced a bill to eliminate the state's brand new red flag laws, which Democrats and Governor Gretchen Whitmer passed back into law in 2023. DeSana is quoted by saying, "The red flag laws are a direct violation of our Second Amendment rights. These poorly written laws strip away our rights without the opportunity for individuals to defend themselves." Really? Really? They go against the Second Amendment, DeSana? Well, how come Livingston County Sheriff Mike Murphy, who I'm surmising is one of your favorite sheriffs in the state since he's being viewed by your side as a constitutional sheriff, meaning that he just ignores laws he doesn't like, how come Sheriff Murphy, even Sheriff Murphy, who opposed these bills, ended up using the new law to help protect the people in his county? I mean, I'll be darned. When push comes to shove, MAGA Republicans will use the bills they supposedly hate because deep down inside, they know the bills work. And if it's unconstitutional, why hasn't the right-wing Supreme Court deemed it as such? I mean, it's not like this court is pro-assault weapons ban, James DeSana. Oh, and he's trying to say that there's no due process and everyone deserves to have their day in court. Of course they do. But as John King notes in the story, the process set up by the legislation does require any order to temporarily prohibit people from accessing firearms be approved by a judge. It has to go through the courts. But gun nuts like James DeSana either doesn't know that or doesn't want his people knowing it. And we know how MAGA Republicans are when it comes to the truth. Look, many Republicans voted against the red flag laws, the safe storage laws, the expanded background check laws to help curb the gun violence epidemic in our country. These are the very same people who will wear AR-15 lapel pins as a way to own the libs, showing little empathy or concern for family members who've died from that killing machine. I don't know, maybe they're teaching different things in church nowadays, but all they do, it's just talk trash. They've got no solutions to help people. They have no philosophy. I mean, just as I talked about last week, how Oxford MAGA Republican weakling and bigot Joshua Shriver introduced a resolution to overturn same-sex marriage. Now, apparently, Republican State House Speaker Matt Hall is not going to let that resolution reach the floor, which just shows you how much they understand that they are on the wrong side of history on that one. These people have nothing to offer. They have no philosophy or no policy stances other than attacking and punishing people that they've been taught to groom, to hate, and to do whatever their corporate donors tell them to do. Let's move on to MAGA Michigan office holders in our United States Congress. Lisa McClain makes it back to my show here for the second consecutive week. Last week, I played a soundbite where McClain, whose district consists of Macomb County traveling north to the Thumb, complained about all of those regular, angry, working-class constituents who are attending those Republican congressional town hall meetings. Many of you have seen them already online or maybe on TV. The people are angry, but Lisa whined because the people were holding their representatives' feet to the fire on how Elon is gutting essential services while making moves to help enrich he and his tech bro autocrats. I mean, the people are catching up to this game, and Lisa is angry at the people. Of course she is. So this week, she appeared on MSNBC and said that billionaire George Soros is paying all these people attending these town halls. Listen.
And you specifically cite that George Soros funded organizers are coming and disrupting these town halls. Where has that happened? Can you give us some examples of that?
All you need to do is turn on the TV, and it's all over the place.
I have to wonder, what will MAGA Republicans do when George Soros passes away? I mean, who will be the next monster for them? But what I love the most is that Lisa McClain is caught in an easy-to-prove lie. She's got no evidence that George Soros is driving voters to these Republican town hall events, but that's how these MAGA Republicans are when push comes to shove. Once the people see how wretched their policies are to the working class, they turn to boogeymen like George Soros or a couple of transgender Americans playing sports or, my favorite, DEI. And again, we'll talk about that more here in a few moments. Perhaps Lisa McClain should learn why her and her MAGA Republican colleagues' voters are upset. Maybe a lot of voters aren't exactly thrilled with President Musk's plans to, I don't know, gut 80,000 jobs from the Veterans Affairs Department. This would cut the VA staff to 2019 levels. And there wouldn't be enough staff to care for veterans who are now covered under the PACT Act, which was passed by Democrats and signed into law by Joe Biden, which covered over 1 million more veterans, including those affected by burn pits in Afghanistan and other places. The science is showing how these burn pits are linked to several illnesses sustained by our veterans, and that includes breast cancer. Oops, I think I found the link. I see why Elon's going after the VA. We can't be taking care of those women, and trust me, many of his tech bros and white Christian nationalists are more than eager to ensure we don't cover women who've sustained long-term injuries while serving this country overseas. See, to them, they're just women. Or maybe Lisa McClain, John James, John Molinar, and all of the rest of the MAGA Michigan Republican congressional members would understand that people don't want some billionaire corporate authoritarian running our government, cutting funding and jobs that help people, including right here in Michigan. Musk and his underlings have tried to gut USAID, which provided federal funding to our universities to help people across the world. President Kennedy started USAID as a way to build humanitarian goodwill across the world and to ensure that some countries would stick with the U.S. Yes, of course, it was political and it was the Cold War, but it helped with research and technology that we also benefited from. Bridge Michigan reported how MSU received approximately $23 million in U.S. aid awards in fiscal year 2024. These funds help pay for agricultural and food-related research. Research, which helps aid our country's farmers. That means it helps Michigan farmers and helps them export their goods to overseas markets. And they also benefit from the research to help ensure that their crops remain healthy each and every year. But President Elon and dear leader Trump are fighting to end those programs because they'd rather funnel that money back to their corporate buddies. Now, the Supreme Court just ruled in a 5-4 decision that Musk and Trump unconstitutionally blocked $2 billion in foreign aid spending, with John Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett joining with the three liberal judges there. So that's actually some good news, maybe? I don't know. We'll have to see where those two continue the rule here for the next couple of years. But with these freezes nearly being a month old, who knows how much damage has already been done? Gutting the federal government so a corporate authoritarianism can gain power is the ultimate game here, everyone. That's what's happening right in front of our eyes. And Michigan is suffering from just 6 weeks of dear leader and Elon Musk being in power. And I haven't even mentioned the 25% tariffs that they put on Canada and Mexico. Although, isn't it a little interesting that dear leader put a one-month pause for the big three auto industry after they complained after just 1 day on how prices would skyrocket for their cars? I mean, it just goes to show there's no real philosophy going on here. It's just chaos day in and day out. And that's what makes for great TV, right? Perhaps that's why people are angry at MAGA Republican town halls, Lisa McClain. Maybe they don't want their Social Security being gutted. Maybe they don't want their Medicaid being gutted. Maybe they see themselves as playing by the rules and getting screwed by a corporate authoritarian class. Oh, and of course, for all of their bluster and for all of their speeches and talk of free speech, I always love that one, it appears they're no longer going to hold town halls. Yeah, Republicans are going to slither away back into their corporate overlords' arms so that way they don't have to hear from those angry working class constituents wondering why their Medicaid and Social Security are being attacked, why inflation is still out of control, and why essential services are being shut down by an unelected billionaire. And by the way, our universities and public schools are also under attack. I've already shared with you how they're attacking research funding at MSU, just to give one of many examples. But these executive orders and federal funding for universities affects research in discovering cures for diseases and new technologies, and also in helping create jobs and helping sustain cities and towns where these universities reside. You know what helps make America great? We've known for a long time how eager right-wing forces have been to gut the university system, since they view places of higher learning as evil, true evil. It goes back to Nixon and, you know, who knows, maybe beyond. But starving public institutions like universities of federal funding is one step in their war. And that's why it's more important than ever for universities to stand up and resist these attacks. Now, Musk and Trump are trying to cut funding by forcing or scaring universities to drop their DEI programs, which help expand opportunity for so many marginalized Americans. And that's the point, maybe. And who knows? Today, it's DEI programs. Tomorrow, for them, it could be students who protest on campuses. Oh, wait, Trump already issued another threat against schools for those who might protest. That's why you cannot shrink. This is the time to fight back. Joining me to talk about these attacks against our universities and K-12 schools is Western Michigan University education scholar Dr. Julian Vasquez Heilig. I've been looking forward to this discussion for quite some time, and it is coming up. You're listening to LOL.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com.
Okay, one of the early acts by the Trump regime has been to weaken or attempt to eliminate entirely diversity, equality, or inclusion programs at colleges and universities, and also in K-12 schools. Acting Assistant Director of the Department of Education, Craig Traynor, sent a Dear Colleague memo in which he detailed how any school will be in danger of losing its federal funding if it does not abide by Trump's interpretation of the 2023 Students for Fair Admissions v. Harvard case. Now, it was in that case where the right-wing majority on the Supreme Court reversed decades of precedent by ending both public and private universities and colleges from considering race when deciding which applicants are qualified or not. Trump's Education Department wrote in that letter that I mentioned that the court's ruling states how the federal government is prohibited from using race in decisions pertaining to admissions, hiring, promotion, compensation, financial aid, scholarships, prizes, administrative support, discipline, housing, graduation ceremonies, and all other aspects of student, academic, and campus life. Now, this letter had educators across the state of Michigan and across the entire nation scrambling on exactly what to do. Education scholar and Western Michigan University professor Julian Vasquez Heilig wrote a terrific response in which he refuted many of Craig Traynor's so-called points, and you can find that on his Cloaking Inequities site. This piece is titled, U.S. Department of Education's 14-Day Ultimatum on Equal Opportunity, Will Universities Surrender or Resist? Dr. Vasquez Heilig is a professor of education leadership, research, and technology at Western, and I'm so pleased to have him on the show here this week. Professor, thanks for taking some time to talk with us.
It's so great to join you on your podcast.
Before we get started, you are a native Michigander, correct?
I am. Your listeners may be thinking, why have we never heard of this guy? I'll tell you why. But, you know, I grew up in Lansing on the south side where MLK and Miller meet. There's equality dairy there. Went to Atwood Elementary and a few other schools in the Lansing area. So born in Ann Arbor, that's where I ended up going for undergraduate and graduate. But about 2000, I moved to Texas to work for Rod Page when he was superintendent of the Houston School Districts before he became Secretary of Education. So the last 20 or so years, I've been living in California and Texas and Kentucky, but I am so, so glad to be back home in the Mitten.
What made you get interested into wanting to study education and higher education in general?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I come from a long legacy of educators. My family was from Saginaw, Buena Vista, which is just a little south of Bay City, a little north of Flint. That district was one of the first casualties of Governor Snyder. And my aunt was the first African-American superintendent of that district. My grandmother was a librarian in Houghton Middle School. My great-grandmother was chair of the school board. So I come from a long legacy of African-American educators.
All right. Well, let's talk about this this 14-day deadline that I mentioned by the Department of Education. Of course, now I want to mention that this deadline has passed and that the department issued some so-called clarifications to its original letter. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But I'd first like to just kind of go back and have you talk about what this letter from Acting Assistant Education Secretary Craig Trainor's main goal or goals was all about, since I just kind of gave a broad overview there, as you heard in my intro. And I'd rather have you talk more about it, Professor. Please, the floor is yours to talk about what was in this letter and why its main goal was to, and this is a quote I found, scare and chill schools, as one of your fellow educators said in USA Today recently.
So some of the things we're going to talk about today are somewhat dense. I'm going to try to make them as if I'm having a conversation with my family or my parents. And so first, this letter is from the Office of Civil Rights. Now, this office is typically examines different discrimination claims and ensures that districts and universities and other educational institutions are not discriminating. So there were thousands of cases on the docket within the Office of Civil Rights, and the word out of DC is that they've released all of those cases. And now they've taken up these what are called reverse racism cases. But I want to tell your listeners, DEI is not reverse racism. What DEI does is it's research-based practices that help us create success for historically marginalized populations. And that's really a wide, diverse range of students, professors, teachers. And what we want to do is if we bring Black students to campus, we want to make sure they graduate. If we're trying to attract veteran students to our campus, we want to make sure it's easy for their officer school credits to transfer so that they can get done in 4 years and 5 years and 6 years. Students with disabilities, what are the services that we need to provide them? There is a wide range of things that diversity covers. It's not about reverse racism. What it's about is how can we create opportunities for all students, Jewish students, et cetera, on our campus? And how can we do it in research-based ways? And so I think it's just really unfortunate that there's been this twisting of DEI to make it about African-Americans, or I don't get this if you get that. No, that is not what diversity, equity, inclusion is about. It's about how do we create success for everyone on our campus. So really, it's a mischaracterization of policies that improve success for everyone. We don't want just a small segment of students to be successful in our K-12 schools or are successful in higher education. We want them all. And so that's why you see this fallacy of reverse racism. It's really an attack on student success. Now, what's interesting is that there's a lot of overreach in this letter. And one of the interesting things that it does, which I think is really unfortunate, is a frontal assault on the U.S. Supreme Court's Chief Justice, because they claim in this letter that you can't use student essays or writing samples or participation in extracurriculars or other what they call as cues to determine or predict a student's race. But the Chief Justice was very clear. He said in the Harvard case, the recent Harvard affirmative action case, quote, "Nothing in this opinion should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of race and how that has affected his or her life." And you can extend that to being a veteran, to having a disability, whatever, being Jewish, whatever that may be. And so really, this letter directly contradicts the decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, it's been challenged. For example, one of the holds that's been placed in the courts was filed by the Chief Diversity Officers Association. And so a lot of what you see with these executive orders is nonstop legal challenges, because as one of my colleagues recently said on the line, You can't use an executive order to violate the Constitution. So one example that's being litigated besides the education is the birthright citizenship. And so across the spectrum of these executive orders and these orders coming out of the different departments in the government is there's extensive legal challenges across the gamut. And so that's why I think you've seen some pullback. But even just today, you see in the news that Trump declared on Truth Social that students who were involved in, quote, illegal protests should be expelled. If they're not a U.S.-based student, that they should be deported out of the country, right? And this is the new litmus test or requirement to get federal funding. So first, they started with DEI. You will not receive federal funding if you have DEI. Now they're saying you will not receive federal funding if you have student protests on your campus. And so this is a very slippery slope, because what is next? Is it unions? Is the Trump administration going to say, you will not get federal funding if you have campus unions, if faculty unions or graduate student unions? And then you could see 4 years from now, let's say a Democrat comes into office, a Democrat president could say exactly the opposite, right? And you get this whipsaw. They could say, if you do not have DEI programs, you will not receive any federal funding. Now, the reason why this is important, and this is, I'll wrap with this thought. The reason why this is so important is over the last 100 years or so, universities and also K-12 districts have become very dependent on federal funding. Some of that has been the inequality in spending. And so Title I helped us address that somewhat in K-12 schools. So that Title I funding is dependent on the government. And there's other titles there too. But then there's also funding that comes through for higher education, research grants. And K-12 districts get some of those research grants too. But you saw the pause on NSF, some NSF funding, some IES funding, NIH, National Institutes of Health. And I know that I'm throwing a lot of abbreviations at you. But the bottom line is that behind the scenes, what's going on in colleges and universities is that the cabinets, executive cabinets, the provost, the presidents, they're looking at six-figure deficits, seven-figure deficits. Because if the federal government pulls back from their century-long work around research funding, funding for science, for health, climate change, whatever it is that funding is related to, then universities and colleges are going to face enormous deficits. And there's only a few options there. One of the things that I said in Democracy Now, and Amy asked me about this, is you have two choices. It's this patronage system where if you have unions, you can't have funding. If you have DEI, you can't have funding. If you have student protesters, you can't have funding, and whatever the flavor of the week is. Or the other option is we are going to have to think about how do we politics proof our institutions so that we're not whipsawed as the political ideologies change in DC. Because before, research was not tied to any particular ideology. It was simply that we had these big problems we needed to solve, and universities across the United States would engage in that work. But now we have this string-attached patronage system.
So in the way that you just put it there, it seems like then they're just using DEI, or they're threatening protesting students, or like you said, maybe soon. And I wouldn't doubt it that they would say, hey, if your university has unionized professors, hey, we're going to have to cut your federal funding. That is the ultimate goal, right? Is slashing federal funding to these universities to starve them out.
Well, that's a great question. And it's part of the playbook, right? If you look at different countries, let's say you look at Russia, right? So in Russia, what you see, and actually I just blogged about this today, and what are the sort of requirements that when folks want to, or politicians, I should say, want to control universities, how did they exert that control, right? And so one of the things you see is Russia and China and Hungary, even Viktor Orban, they use different leverage, especially financial leverage, to limit academic freedom, to limit the funding flows. This is a playbook. Now, other parts of the playbook, if you look at the research by political science, it's control of the media, control of curriculum. And so there is literally an autocratic playbook that political scientists and others have identified. And we are right at the beginning of that playbook. Putin said recently, to win wars, you start with teachers, something to that effect. And the premise of that is that education is very powerful in terms of creating citizens, creating knowledge, and also framing history. Even before all of this happened, you saw African-American history getting banned in Texas. You saw in Florida legislation that empowered parents to ban books and take them off the shelf. And of course, those books were primarily focused on communities of color and other marginalized communities. And so there is this extensive, and I like to call it a blitzkrieg, because it's happening very quickly on purpose. Because there are some folks, there are some universities that are just simply going to comply because, quite frankly, they want it to comply. Then there are other universities that, while publicly they might not comply, they are behind the scenes complying. And then I think there's a whole other set of universities that are working in coalitions to push back against this political whipsaw. And so I think it's important to understand that there's a playbook that they're following. And I think second, I think it's important to understand that universities and school districts, they can fall into one of these three categories. You saw Ohio State and the University of Texas at Austin, for example, completely cancel their DEI work, lay off folks. And that's really unfortunate. Now, we haven't seen that yet in Michigan en masse. I think everyone will be keeping their eyes open. I know that there's been proposed diversity cuts at Michigan approaching 50%, but I don't think anything has been finalized there. So it's very worrisome that after decades of focusing on student success, faculty success, whether it's K-12 or higher ed educator success, I should say, that we're in this place where political ideology is going to determine how institutions make decisions. And we need to make those decisions in the best interest of students.
Can you talk about how opponents of DEI, the right wing, how they've been very successful in putting DEI in such a negative light? Is that some of our fault that we didn't do a good enough job of saying DEI is really about anti-discrimination? And those who are trying to get rid of DEI, what they're basically doing is attacking non-discrimination policies. Did we not do a good enough job in that PR battle?
Well, because I think they have been able to make it a political boogeyman, right? Now, if you ask a Republican to define DEI, they're not able to do it.
Right.
I think that's unfortunate. And maybe that's on me that we haven't been able to communicate with him the actual work that happens around DEI in K-12 and higher ed. Maybe that's on us. I'm not sure. Or maybe it's purposeful ignorance. I don't know. But I call it DEI-ism. I blogged about it today as the new McCarthyism. Huh. Because what they're doing is it's the McCarthyism playbook. Right? It's strategic. It's coordinated. They brand DEI as unnecessary, biased, and dangerous. So these are really sort of familiar terms. And you see these sort of secretive investigations. I was talking with a faculty member from University of Maine yesterday, and now they're being targeted by Washington after you saw what happened between the Maine governor. So there's this fear and threats are involved. And so really it's a moment of reckoning for higher education. I think first, like you say, we have to define DEI as something that is for everyone. That is the bottom line, is that DEI is for everyone. It's not for a particular group. What we want to be able to do is we want to promote the success of all students. So let's say you have a high school in Detroit, and we've had very few students come to our university from that high school in Detroit. We have to do targeted work to recruit that high school. We have to hire somebody to recruit Detroit for us that has relationships in that city so that counselors, principals, families feel comfortable sending students to our university. It's not as simply as saying as opening up our application portal and saying, everybody come. Let me give you Chicago as an example. So I think 30 to 40% of students in Chicago now identify as Latino. And so you have got to realize that when you recruit Latino student, you're recruiting their family. You're also recruiting their community, right? And if you don't do well with one student, they go back home and they talk about their experience on your campus and what the climate was like. And so these are just two very specific examples of how we have to do targeted work. And the work that we have to do for Jewish students and to ensure their success and to address anti-Semitic issues on campuses, we have to do different work from African Americans for Jewish students. And for students who are Palestinian or of Arabic descent, there's different work to be done there too. A kid from up north in Charlevoix or Houghton, there's different work that we have to do on climate for those students. And so that's what DEI is. It's helping us do tailored work so that we can address students and meet them where they are. It's important for us to express to folks that DEI is not about discriminating or reverse discrimination. It's about success for everyone and how we do targeted work to create that success.
is another one of the ultimate goals, though, from that letter that we're talking about from the Trump administration, is to, I guess, maybe get universities into a frame of mind, or at least higher education institutions into this frame of mind that, hey, we don't even want to spend money on litigating this. So why don't we just cut our losses and cut these initiatives?
Yeah. I remember I heard out of Ann Arbor that when Ono went to testify, and he testified behind closed doors, because part of this critical race theory, then it moved to anti-Semitism, then it moved to DEI, and it's been a very organized playbook. When I heard that when Ono went to testify, that it cost the University of Michigan several million dollars for him to testify behind closed doors. And so hiring the lawyers and doing this work on your own is very difficult and expensive. But I'm aware that the APLU, ASCU, and these are the large associations of colleges and universities of different types, right? So the AUs are the large research universities. APLUs are the large land grants in other state universities, and ASCU are the sort of smaller 10,000 person student colleges. They're involved with, APLU sent an email to its members the other day, and they're involved in the first litigation in the entire history of the association related to various executive orders. Yes, attorneys are a very expensive proposition, but I think the key is that third category of colleges and universities that I talked about in a prior answer is building coalitions. So those universities have to work together in these associations. They have to work together with their accreditors, because like I mentioned on Democracy Now!, the reason why accreditors are being targeted is because accreditors set the standards in higher education. And if we go against our accreditation standards, we can lose our accreditation. And so one of the things that we have to do to respond to some of these executive orders is they violate our accreditation, and we don't want to lose our accreditation, right? And with Trump talking about a new privatized national university, he would need an accreditor to agree to accredit his university for those degrees to be valid in all 50 states. So there is a lot of opportunity for institutions to work together and to limit the cost. But inevitably, the administration has unlimited spending power because they have the Justice Department and they have attorneys and OCR, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, this battle is not going to be inexpensive for those institutions that believe that what's being asked of them is unconstitutional. It limits academic freedom. It limits freedom of speech. And so yes, I do think that this work will be costly, but it's work that should be done in coalitions and in community.
We touched on the goal of starving universities of federal funding. You just talked about, Trump talked about, what was it, some kind of private university? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the clips that Amy played on Democracy Now! Last Friday was Trump announcing a couple of years ago that he wanted to start a new national university. Now, as we know, he had some legal issues with Trump University. I think folks are probably aware of that. But he's proposed a new national university. Now, I haven't read that he said that it would be privatized, but I suspect as he talks about universities and how inaccessible and expensive they are, that he's trying to offer an alternative privatized national university. But there are already, of course, as you know, many privatized private universities, for-profit universities. There's many already. Interestingly, the Corinthian colleges and several others, you know, the U.S. Department of Education let students off the hook because these were predatory universities that really weren't that interested in students graduating and had some of the lowest graduation rates of any colleges and universities in the United States. So The idea that privatizing universities will solve a quality problem or a cost problem is not really believable because of the record of for-profit colleges, especially the Corinthian colleges and others, where the U.S. Department of Education forgave billions of dollars in loans because of that malfeasance.
Is privatization the end result of what this is all about?
Well, you know, we were talking about the playbook for autocracies. And if you go back decades, and folks sometimes get a little uncomfortable when I start talking about other countries, because if it didn't happen in the United States, then it just never happened at all. But I think it's important for us to look at other countries' educational policy and learn lessons. And so when Pinochet, the dictator, went into Chile, one of the things he prioritized was privatizing education, because it goes back to Putin's quote, you win wars with teachers, right? And so what they did was they created a voucher. And I know you had Josh Cowan on your show not too long ago. So I just want to give a shout out for his book about privatization and vouchers. He's doing such great work and is a good friend. We actually had dinner not too long ago. But one of the things that we see in this playbook, again, just understand this is all part of a playbook that we've seen in other countries and quite frankly, that we saw in the 1940s too. So you have this playbook. And what he did was he created a voucher program and empowered churches and to run schools. He also left some public schools, and then they concentrated other students, and I'm using air quotes here, the less desirable, lower achieving students in a whole other set of schools. And so they're able to control the curriculum, they control the resources and all the different commercial parts of education by privatizing it. And so I think it's important that education, especially public education, whether it's K-12 public education or higher education that's public education, that it's a public good. It's not a private good. It's not a good that we want to profit off the backs of students. We want to be able to pour all the resources of our institutions into student success, faculty success, and staff success. Yes, part of the playbook is to privatize K-12. And honestly, every time school vouchers, and this is for K-12, have gone up for a vote in states, they've lost every single time. They're very, very unpopular. But that doesn't stop politicians from saying, hey, we need to privatize your school. And so, yes, I think what you see here is a push for K-12 privatization of education. You also have this push for higher education privatization. But I think it's pretty clear that education as a public good and free of politics is a better outcome for students and focuses more on their success rather than profits.
I have so much more I'd love to talk to you about here, but we're just running out of time. Education scholar and Western Michigan University professor Julian Vasquez-Heilig. I will provide a link to your site, Cloaking Inequity. And you've also got a podcast?
Yeah, I have a podcast, but it's a very specific podcast. And it's about teacher quality and Teach for America. And really, we only run the podcast when people come to us with a story. So you can find it on iTunes. You can find it on SoundCloud. It's called Truth for America. And it's about the experiences that teachers have in schools and challenges with those. But also be sure to check out my blog, Cloaking Inequity. It's been a labor of love for more than 12 years, more than 1.2 million readers, more than 200 countries. And I've been on fire of late talking about what's happening out of DC and what its impact is going to be on schools in your neighborhood and how it's going to impact the colleges and universities in our state.
Now, you do an excellent job there, and I'll make sure to put a link there. And I have to just tell you, Doctor, as a Central Michigan graduate, this is one of the most interesting discussions I've ever had with anyone affiliated with Western. So thank you so much for being on. I'd love to have you back on again soon, if that's okay.
Yeah, lots of family members went to CMU. Go Chips.
It's Michigan's premier progressive podcast, Left of Lansing with Pat Johnston. If Pat's brand of progressive pontifications is getting you all riled up and you'd like to give him a piece of your mind, or if you'd like to tell him he's doing an outstanding job and to keep up the great work, just email him. That's leftoflansing@gmail.com. Do you have stories you think Pat must know about or guest ideas for future episodes? That's leftoflansing@gmail.com. Want to share your thoughts on how to grow Michigan's population or which flavor of Faygo Pop is the best? It's Rock and Rye, by the way. Just email Pat, leftoflansing@gmail.com. Now, here's Pat.
Hey, thanks again to Dr. Julian Vasquez-Heilig for appearing on the show this week and offering his expertise on these MAGA Republican attacks on higher education. I mean, certainly everyone has heard about the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. I don't think there's many of you who've never heard it. And we heard how Trump was staffing his education department with critics of public schools and universities. And Professor Vasquez-Heilig, he knew what was happening, but I'm not sure that many Democrats and even some in higher education were ready for the level of attacks that we are now seeing or even believed these kinds of attacks would ever occur in the first place. And now, the Department of Education unveiled an NDEI portal, which basically serves as a snitch line for those who want to punish schools for having anti-discrimination policies or for teaching true American history or whatever. Guys, it is on. It is on, everyone. And we have to make as many people out there know that this corporate authoritarian takeover is in motion, or else they will achieve everything that Project 2025 has ever dreamed of doing. Oh, and you heard the professor there mention how Dear Leader Trump announced how universities could lose federal funding if their students engage in quote-unquote illegal protesting. Hey, what does that mean? Oh, I miss the days when MAGA Republicans used to be for free speech and they were free speech warriors, don't you? You know, I think I'm beginning to conclude that they were never free speech absolutists that they claim to be, and that they only want certain people having freedom of speech. I think I'm catching on to their game. Of course, I always knew they were full of it. I mean, the whole point was to shut down freedom of speech for those who don't agree with the corporate authoritarian white Christian nationalist MAGA Republican way. It's just sad that some others didn't believe it. Time for the left of Lansing, last call.
President Trump is trying to deliver an unprecedented giveaway to his billionaire friends. He's on the hunt to find trillions of dollars to pass along to the wealthiest in America. And to do that, he's going to make you pay in every part of your life. Grocery and home prices are going up, not down. And he hasn't laid out a credible plan to deal with either of those. His tariffs on allies like Canada will raise prices on energy, lumber, and cars, and start a trade war that will hurt manufacturing and farmers. Your premiums and prescriptions will cost more because the math on his proposals doesn't work without going after your health care. Meanwhile, for those keeping score, the national debt is going up, not down. And if he's not careful, he could walk us right into a recession.
Of course, that was Michigan Democratic U.S. Senator Alyssa Slotkin giving the Democratic Party response to Dear Leader's 18-hour Liathon extravaganza, otherwise known as his address to Congress last week. Now, if you follow me on Blue Sky or Twitter or Facebook, I explained why I was less than enthused how the Dems chose my state's freshman senator to respond to the growing corporate authoritarianism in this country. You have to recall that she barely won her race, her Senate race, against Florida Mike Rogers, a race she could have won by 5 to 10 percentage points easily against that clown. And it turned out being close because she ran as this I'm bipartisan campaign at a time when other Democrats were telling us how democracy was on the line. So people really didn't exactly know what she stood for. She decided to run MAGA Lite and she almost lost. So what did the Democratic Party learn from this past election loss? Not to tap into the visceral anger that millions are feeling by Elon Musk and Dear Leader, but to pretend that, you know, things are still normal. Yeah, everything's still normal, and the best way to win back power is to try to convert MAGA Republicans rather than trying to connect with the millions of voters out there who did not participate in the election last November. Oh, man, it's just so angering at times. And so they played it safe by choosing Alyssa Slotkin, and it seems like she's receiving some lukewarm reviews. Now, don't get me wrong. Giving the rebuttal to a president's State of the Union address is always an impossible task to succeed. I know that. Everybody knows that. And I've yet to have watched one rebuttal from either party that people remember fondly 7 days later. So I understand that Slotkin was facing some stiff odds to begin with. And look, I don't care if I upset some of you, but I'm going to try to be fair in my overall assessment of her speech. As a communications and broadcasting graduate and practitioner, I thought the senator did fine. As you heard from that clip I just played, she did a good job at times when she pointed out how this regime is hurting the working class with Dear Leader's ridiculous tariffs on our allies, which will hurt our manufacturing and also hurt farmers, and how they're also going after Medicaid and Social Security.
In order to pay for his plan, he could very well come after your retirement. The Social Security, Medicare, and VA benefits you worked your whole life to earn. The president claims he won't, but Elon Musk just called Social Security the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time.
Again, I have no issues with what she just said there, and I'm glad that she included President Musk in her speech as well.
Is there anyone in America who is comfortable with him and his gang of 20-year-olds using their own computer servers to poke through your tax returns, your health information, and your bank accounts? No oversight, no protections against cyber attack, no guardrails on what they do with your private data.
I mean, look, that's the part that's driving angry voters to these Republican town halls, an unelected multi-billionaire tech bro who's benefited from tons of corporate welfare cash, is gaining access to our personal data. And I'd love to know who really wants Elon Musk having access to our records with no oversight, since Republicans don't mind being steamrolled by Musk and their Dear Leader Trump. So again, I thought those were pretty effective parts. But then there were some low points to the speech, including this one on immigration.
As someone who spent my whole career protecting our homeland, every country deserves to know who and what is coming across its border. Period. Democrats and Republicans should all be for that. But securing the border without actually fixing our broken immigration system is dealing with the symptom and not the disease.
Slotkin's not wrong in saying securing the border without fixing our immigration system is treating a symptom of a disease. All right, very well. But then she and her fellow Michigan Democratic Senator Gary Peters voted for the Lake and Riley Act, which gives Musk and Trump the power to chisel away even more at the due process of migrant workers. Because as we've learned, when it comes to MAGA Republicans, they'll stop right there, right? I mean, they won't try to keep pushing to expel other people that they love to hate. They'll just stop right there. Come on. Senator Slotkin was afraid right after the election, and she went along with MAGA in voting in favor of this horrible freaking law. I mean, she's guilty of doing what she just said, treating a symptom while the disease of a broken immigration system marches merrily along. And then there's this.
President Trump loves to say peace through strength. That's actually a line he stole from Ronald Reagan. But let me tell you, after the spectacle that just took place in the Oval Office last week, Reagan must be rolling in his grave. We all want an end to the war in Ukraine. But Reagan understood that true strength required America to combine our military and economic might with moral clarity.
Okay, she's not wrong saying Dear Leader is more comfortable cozying up to dictators than he is with our own allies, as we've seen him doing by choosing Russia over Ukraine, of course. But invoking Ronald Reagan? The actor? Who is moved by that kind of argument? True, Reagan probably is rolling in his grave at this moment, but let's not lionize Ronald Reagan's Cold War record or his overall record. It just proves to me that while MAGA Republicans continue moving the Overton window further and further and further to the extreme right wing, so-called centrist Democrats, and still, I need people to explain to me exactly what is a moderate, what is a centrist. Nobody really can explain that to me. Anyway, it just proves to me that so-called centrist Democrats like Senator Slotkin are happy to keep creeping to the right themselves, rather than trying to pull things back to the left. Then there was this.
As a Cold War kid, I'm thankful it was Reagan and not Trump in office in the 1980s. Trump would have lost us the Cold War.
Okay, look, I'm a Cold War kid too. I grew up in the 80s with all the Cold War, Red Scare crap. I grew up watching Rocky IV. I grew up having to listen to that unbearable and sickening Lee Greenwood, Proud to Be an American song. But guess what? I grew up then, and I know Reagan's record during the Cold War was atrocious. Not to mention he gutted the safety net for millions of Americans, damaged America's farmers, weakened unions, went back to the pre-Great Depression rules for reckless Wall Street banksters, hyperinflated our defense budget while our national debt began to rise significantly. And by the way, Elon, are you going to go after the Defense Department? It doesn't sound like you really are. Oh, and hey, there was also the whole AIDS crisis, and Reagan did very little for years on that front. Ronald Reagan was atrocious. And Ronald Reagan is why we have Donald Trump. Reagan begat Trump. It all started with Ronald Reagan. They are the same. When people say, oh, the MAGA Republicans are different from the moderate Republicans, no. They've always been MAGA Republicans. They're just more outspoken now. That's the only difference. And I remember that there was a time when Democrats were pretty uniform in understanding how much harm Ronald Reagan did to this country and to the world. And now today, we're spending time on praising Reagan during a rebuttal speech against Trump and the Republicans. That's what Democrats are doing? And that gets to my final point about Alyssa Slotkin's speech. Not only was it trying to be too Midwestern nice or too bipartisan, but it contained no calls to action in terms of policy goals that Democrats want to pursue. It contained no bold counter proposals to what Dear Leader and Musk are doing. Democrats used to dream big and fight for big things, like Truman did when he called for what would be known as Medicare, something that JFK and LBJ would later fight for and LBJ passed. We used to be for strengthening the social safety net, which is why FDR passed Social Security. We fought for civil rights as proposed by JFK and passed by LBJ. We used to try to do things to help the world, which of course would help our nation's economy through USAID, something which was started by JFK, but that Elon Musk and Dear Leader Trump are trying to destroy for good. Democrats can't be nice. They can't be timid. I know the Democratic leadership in D.C. believes that timidity and being just safe is always the perfect play. Not in these times. that people have to know that you are on their side. Our side lost this election for a number of reasons, and refusing to give bold policies to fix up and make right for our working class after horrible decisions by the political class, you know, like passing NAFTA, for example, is one step in the right direction. I mean, we don't have any bold ideas, which really sucks. It really does, because people are hurting and they have tuned out. I mean, I believe that you have to give something for people to want to vote on, and they'll do it if they believe that you are on their side. But playing it safe and saying that we'll try to get things back to normal around here when normal hasn't worked for the last 50 years, that, everybody, is a failed strategy. Playing it safe is a failed strategy. And by not being bold and taking the battle to them, we fail the majority of Americans. And we'll continue to watch Democrats live in the minority.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan. It's Pat Johnston.
That's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Special thanks again to Western Michigan education scholar Dr. Julian Vasquez Heilig for appearing on the show. I will link to his site called Cloaking Inequity. And like he said, he's been posting a lot there lately on the attacks against higher education's DEI policies and more. I'd love to hear your thoughts about what we've covered here this week in my interview or my review of Senator Slotkin's speech and more. Email me, leftoflansing@gmail.com, or leave your comments on Blue Sky, Facebook, or Twitter, and I can respond to you there as well. I appreciate you all for listening, and let others know of the show so that way we can help spread the progressive message and voice across the state of Michigan and beyond. Look, dear leaders, tariffs are going to cause some pain. Dear leaders, massive cuts to the social safety net are definitely going to cause a lot more pain, as intended by many in the elite corporate class. And it's time for Democrats to understand the ballgame and that we're in a whole new ballgame. Until next week, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston. Written by Pat Johnston. Researched by Pat Johnston. Edited by Pat Johnston. And hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.